Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, back in, distant past May or so of 2005, I tried to get a mortgage broker friend of mine to come on the show because it was obvious to me that the expanding bubble of the housing market was about to pop at some point. It was just a question of when. And I wanted him to come on the show and talk with me about the mortgage practices and what the outlook was for a bust, right, in the housing market. But being basically a salesman, he agreed with me. He knew that was coming, but he didn't want to come on the show because, for obvious reasons, that would not be good for business, and he would be electrocuted by his colleagues soon after, I suppose. But so he didn't come on, and we never had such a show. But the show today, lo, these many years later, is toward the end, we hope, of the bust that then did follow that boom, right? And my guest today is a former mortgage broker who's now the author of a book. I was just talking with him about it before the show, and I would call it a self-help book, and he admitted that it is that. But it's more than that, and he's also a motivational speaker. His name is Michael Everett. The book is Recessions End, and that's not recession apostrophe S, it's recessions plural end, stimulus for the rest of us. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks. Thanks to have me here, Court. I'm excited.
Thanks for being on. So I would say that, to me, having read the book, that the self-help and the motivational parts, that I haven't heard you give a talk, but that those two kind of different aspects have, both of them, two different aims, right? So I would think one is kind of economics and some sort of economics 101 description of what's gone on in recent history in our economy and in the housing market. And then the other part is psychological. It's like, what do individuals do about it? How can you get out of your personal recession? And so that's sort of the stimulus for the rest of us part of it. Does that sound pretty fair?
That's a pretty fair assessment. When people ask me that difficult question, what is your book about? It's basically about getting out of a rut. And I separate that into a micro and a macro kind of philosophy, because I believe that as a country, as a macro economy, we are in a rut. And, you know, of course, the media has fed that over and over again by telling us that we're in a rut over and over again. And I think that the cure or the key to getting out of that collective rut is by helping as many individuals as possible get out of their own individual ruts and move on with their lives. And I think once they're able to accomplish that, we will move on as an aggregate.
So kind of, you know, the economy of a country is kind of like the personal fortunes of an individual. A lot of it's psychology, right? And that's a lot of it's leadership and how confidence-inspiring leaders can be. And today, it's how confidence-inspiring or uninspiring the media can be, right? So your book, I think, is an attempt to be kind of explanatory and also confidence-inspiring in that sense. And it's when you say self-help book, people get a certain image of, oh gosh, you know, but it is that, but it's not very cheerleaderish, right? It's, it's an intelligent, well-written book. It's, fast-paced and, you know, it's easy to read. And, you know, I learned some things in reading it. It's, it's an interesting book, and it does give you in a sense of the ability to get up and move on, you know, if you're having trouble doing that. So, you know, the first part of the book, Mike, can we call you Mike?
Absolutely.
First part of Michael Everett's book is his personal story, which is pretty dramatic in some ways itself, and how he got into the situation that led him to write this book. So why don't you kind of give us the thumbnail version of your life for the last few years here, if you can do that.
Well, the Cliff Notes version is pretty easy. I got into the mortgage business in 2001. And that was, of course, pre-boom, when interest rates were still high, real estate was relatively dormant. And of course, 2003, 4, and 5 came along, and I'm working, 11, 12, 13-hour days just trying to keep up with the demand. Then, of course, late 2005, early 2006, the market busts. And I have a wrestling and a football mentality left over from when I was a kid in high school. I have that never quit, drive, 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 go, 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 win, win, win kind of philosophy. And that's what carried me through 2006, 2007, 2008, as we're taking these beatings. And of course, government regulation comes in and makes it even more difficult for us to do. And I was committed to staying in the business. I was going to be the last man standing. And basically, a whole series of circumstances basically forced me to sit down and assess whether I could continue to do that. I went home one night and had what felt very much like a very real heart attack. A bottle broke inside my chest. The numbness and tingling went down the entire left side of my body. And when I went to the hospital, it turns out that I was healthy as a horse. Everything, cholesterol, blood pressure, standing heart rate, everything's just fine.
It was just the cocaine, right? No, just kidding out there.
Nervous laugh.
Yeah, right. So you had not had a heart attack, but it still gave you a wake-up call without the medical after effects.
Well, near as we can figure, they didn't really know what it was, and they couldn't really give me any insight, but the best guess was that it was a nervous breakdown, that finally just my brain staged a strike and just basically said, look, we can't do this anymore. The stress of trying to continue on with this is just too much. And so I literally went and sat under a tree and asked myself, okay, well, you know, I crossed 40 a couple of years ago. What do you want to do with the rest of your life? If you can do anything, what would you like to do? And I'd been making notes on this book. And basically, it was a lot of the things that I'd been explaining to my clients in terms of business cycles, economic cycles, and the way that things work from the 30,000 foot view. And I finally just decided to sit and write it down. And it's funny, you know, we were talking earlier. I thought that I was writing this great economic tome. I really sat down thinking that I was going to write this book for the ages about economic cycles and business cycles. And when I sent it off to the publisher and they came back and categorized it as a self-help motivational book, I was really upset. And then I sat down and read it, and son of a gun, it is.
You had never read an economics tome. I mean, you were a smart guy in a mortgage broker's seat. And so you were seeing patterns, and you could see patterns of individuals' behaviors, and then also the larger economic cycles and patterns in that. And I guess you thought that you were having these revelations that no one had ever had them before.
Exactly. But
that makes your book fresh, though.
But the chances of a Nobel Prize in economics are very, very slim at this point.
I'm not betting on that one. So, but anyway, so you were a mortgage broker and you were in the bull market and everything was going right and you were making money hand over fist, and the only barrier was how fast you could write a mortgage and get it out the door. And then suddenly everything changed overnight and it became the exact flip side of that, and it was all pain and people screaming at you, and you couldn't get a mortgage written, and you couldn't find anybody who could qualify, and so it was like the complete opposite to the extreme of all that, and it basically ground you down like it did so many people, and that's why you're no longer a mortgage broker, like many mortgage brokers are no longer. And so, but anyway, so you reinvented yourself, which is something that a lot of people do in this great country, and so you've written the book called "Recession's End: Stimulus for the Rest of Us." Well, you talked about the business cycles, Mike. Why don't you just kind of give us a quick rundown of why this last very painful thing is not the first or even the second such thing. People call it the Great Recession, like it's the next one since the Great Depression, but it's really just one of many, although maybe worse than most, right? So kind of run us through that a little bit.
Well, the most fascinating thing for me was that when I first started studying recessions as a concept, I was really surprised to see how common they are. As a matter of fact, a lot of people don't realize that we've had 10 of them since 1950, but they happen just far enough apart that they seem like the first time every time. And what I basically did is I identified four phases within a cycle that make up kind of the boom and bust process. We have what I call sludge, and I just made that term up myself. I have no idea if real economists use that or not. But
probably not, but that's good. It's best to be inventive when you write a book.
Well, sludge is that awkward teenage phase in between the technical end of a recession. And by the way, our most recent one technically ended in June of 2009. Mm. And we're in a sludge period right now. It's that phase in between the technical end and the beginning of the next big thing that takes us onward and upward all over again. And so when sludge ends, we have the next big thing. And I like to use the dot-com period as an example. When they finally figured out how to take those massive HAL computers out of IBM and put them on our desktops, back in the mid-90s. And then there were printers and software and companies like AOL.
Well, and the internet and the web.
Exactly. And everyone profited from that. Every market begins in common sense. There's a product. People perceive that product as being useful. They purchase it. The people who provide that product at a profit do well. It begins in common sense. When it gets to the point where a kid who's an hour out of MBA school can write a business plan on a napkin for whatever.com and a financier gives them $250 million, something bad's going to happen.
Yeah.
And something bad did happen. The dot-com bubble burst. So we go from sludge to a booming stock market based on whatever happens to be hot at the time. We did the same thing in the 80s. Then it gets ridiculous and pops. The entire time, the Fed or the Federal Open Markets Committee, you know, Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, they raise interest rates trying to keep inflation in check while our economy's hot. So, you know, as a result, like in 2001, when I got into the business, rates were, almost 9.
Yeah, that's right.
A lot of people don't realize or remember that.
Yeah.
Then they try and keep rates high to keep inflation in check. Well, when a stock market crashes, they do the exact opposite. They lower rates to try and stimulate spending. So they lower what's called the Fed funds rate, which affects the prime rate. Prime rate affects things like credit cards, car loans, lines of credit between banks and businesses trying to stimulate spending. Well, an ancillary or a bonus part of that is that mortgage rates drop. Now, mortgages are bought and sold on the open market using what are called mortgage-backed securities. It's a whole different animal. It's not set by the government. But basically, they trend after the prime rate. So you have the stock market crash, you have interest rates drop, and now suddenly real estate becomes hot again. And you can use even the 80s as an example. When the market crashed in 1987, Alan Greenspan, who, by the way, was brand new on the job in 1987.
Was that right?
Yeah. It's hard to imagine him being brand new at anything. But
yeah, after, you know, 1930. Yeah. But anyway, yeah.
But he got in there, didn't quite know what to do. Federal Open Markets Committee got together, decided to lower interest rates. They did that. Real estate that had been dormant for a decade prior to that became hot. And we had a real estate run from 1988 till about 1991. Same thing that just happened here when the dot-com bubble burst. We had the Fed lowered interest rates from about 2002 to 2005. We had a hot real estate market. It starts off in common sense. When it gets to the point where somebody who's an hour out of bankruptcy can buy a house with no money down and stated income, something bad's going to happen.
That's right. I remember reading back in just prior to the Great Depression in the late 20s, 1928, 29, it got to the point that newsboys, you know, little guys 13 years old selling newspapers on the corner were trading hot stock tips and buying stocks and would get like $5 and run to a broker at the end of the day like they were putting down money on a horse at the bookies and buying stocks. And when it gets to that point, you make the point in your book that the smart money pulls out even before it gets quite to that point, because that's a frenzy. It's a sign of a bubble about to burst, right?
Mm-hmm. When you get to the point where people who don't understand the mechanics of a market are investing in that market because their brother-in-law did really well in it, and he shows up at the family reunion with a Rolex and an Escalade, so you're going to give it a shot, something bad's going to happen. That's your cue that a market's about to pop.
Yeah, that's right. So I think even in Florida, those things may be even more frequent, those boom and bust cycles, and more sharp and severe, as they have been in this last one, because in Florida, the economy is built on tourism and on growth, on development, on people moving in, you know, so there's very little substance to it. It's kind of, there's more hot air in the balloon because, you know, the balloon is just thriving on air only, right? So so when it bursts harder. But anyway, so I think that the idea of buy on the rumor and sell on the news is really a way of expressing what you just said, you know, that that the smart money, whether it's in the housing market or the stock market, sells just when things start to get frenzied. So in the past, it's been very common, and it happened this time too, that when the stock market stopped being profitable, people pulled their money out of it and put it into housing. And then when that stopped being profitable, those who didn't get caught without a chair to sit in when the music ended pulled it out, and maybe have had it sitting on the table, but have been putting it in the market again, and the market's run up again. So there is that back and forth flow of money between those two sectors, and people seem to not have any other idea what to do with their money other than to put it in a money market and make a quarter of a percent on it in between, right? So you're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with author Michael Everett, who has written the book Recession's End, Stimulus for the Rest of Us. And it's about economics, you know, in kind of a populist way, an easy to understand way, and particularly about the business cycle, the boom and bust kind of cycles that we've just seen, hopefully the end of a bust period in with this long running and very severe recession. But I think, to me, that it, you mentioned earlier on, Michael, that this recession is theoretically supposed to, or technically supposed to, have ended in June of 2009. But I think most people didn't feel any sudden changing of gears in June of 2009. I think those people who were suffering at that time, many of them still are. There may be the beginnings of kind of a turnaround here and there, but high oil prices certainly don't help. So, but I think at the same time, a lot of people really never felt a recession. You know, so I think, to me, there's like been a bimodal economy where people who are in those areas where the housing bust rippled outward and affected what they do, whether they're selling carpet or land or cars even, suffered. And a lot of people who work for governments and large corporations where they were not laid off or whatever, had no effect whatsoever. They went on, you know, as if nothing were happening. And so there's been kind of a broadening gap. Would you say that's true? There's kind of a bimodal economy out there, and that the recession is still going on full steam for a lot of people and not for others?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, that it will always be that way because certain sectors do well during certain times. You know, for example, all the folks that were just rocking and rolling in real estate, you know, in 2002, 3, 4, and 5 were doing fantastic at a time, for example, when maybe a bankruptcy attorney was having a really hard time getting any business.
Yeah.
Then the whole thing switches and the bankruptcy attorney has his run, you know, and
along with the divorce attorneys.
Yeah.
Because the two went hand in hand, I think.
Well, you know, a big part of my business in 2007, 2008 was helping people facilitate the mortgage part of their divorce.
Really?
And yeah, it was very sad and very unpleasant.
Along with other unpleasant aspects of being a mortgage broker during those years.
Yeah.
You stuck it out longer than was healthy for you, I gather. So the recovery theoretically started then, but it really doesn't seem any different now. Would you say that the recovery, if there is one going on now, is it fragile? I mean, seems to me maybe, you know, a few more big natural disasters like we've seen a string of around the world and in this country could have a continuing effect on recovery, and maybe one, you know, I hate to say it, but a major terrorist attack, you know, things like that would have a big impact, obviously. Is our economy such now that the recovery, even if it begins to pick up steam, is fragile, do you think?
Yes. You know, without sugarcoating it, yes. You know, and there is the possibility of what they call the double dip recession, where, you know, we went into one, we come back out, and then right when it looks like things are going fine, we go back into one, which is exactly what we did in 1979 and 1980, by the way. We had one 1979 that lasted about 6 months. We came out of it, and then we went back into one that lasted 16 months. And the point that I like to make to people is that this happens over and over and over again. You know, we like to think in this day and age of instant information that we're way more sophisticated than we were, you know, 20, 50, even 100 years ago. And in my research, the oldest recession that I could find was in 1797. It was called the Panic of 1797. It lasted 3 years. And you know what the cause of it was?
No.
Real estate speculation.
I'll be darned.
We do the same things over and over and over again, thinking that we're way more sophisticated than the economies before us. We're pretty much destined to do it over and over again. So as far as a fragile recovery or a fragile economy goes, let's just say hypothetically we do go back into a double dip. Overall, in the big picture, just by economic law, no period of decline, just like no period of growth, can last forever. If for some reason there is some sort of major terrorist attack or inflation comes along and wipes out any gains that we've made.
Well, our gas prices get to $6 a gallon. You know, I mean, that's starting to look not unreasonable again, you know.
So. it was a little scary recently when we were kind of safe in that 250 range there for a while, and all of a sudden 270, almost 280, and you know,
suddenly it's four. But so things like that and can make it fragile. And then there's the prospect of inflation, which is something that people my age have seen, and I don't think people your age and mid-40s or whatever have seen much of, but going back to the early 80s, I can remember when mortgage rates were 12, 13, 14%.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, credit card rates were, I guess they are still high, actually, but you couldn't borrow money for less than about 12% at the time. And inflation was, you know, 3% a year, 4% a year. I mean, prices of things were going noticeably up. Mm-hmm. We haven't really seen that. And it's been, seems to me, held down artificially by the Federal Reserve for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But at a certain point, they can't hold it down forever, and it has to pop. So that, you know, I'm not an economist, even less than you are, maybe. But it seems to me that's a big kind of boogeyman around the corner that has not appeared in a long time, but could suddenly jump out and go, hi, here I am. And a whole lot of people, you know, under 50 or so will not have had any experience with that. And it's a whole new thing that suddenly the prices of everything go up sky high every year.
Mm-hmm. Well, inflation is the elephant in the room right now. And as a matter of fact, it's funny that you and I are talking about it because so many people are talking about it right now, the possibility of inflation. Let's just put it out on the table. Inflation is coming.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is very simple, is that, you know, rates on 30-year fixed money right now is in the high fours, low fives. 15-year fixed money, high threes, low fours. And it's funny that you mentioned that because the Treasury has been keeping rates low. A lot of the TARP money actually has been going towards purchasing our Treasuries at auction every month because they're trying to keep rates low so that we can clear out some of this inventory in this real estate market. We've got, that's the big problem, is we've got so much inventory to clear out post real estate keg party that we've got to move all this out. So inflation's coming. And one of the points that I like to make to people is that if you know that it's coming, there's some inflation hedges that you can take right now. You can, I'm not an investment expert. I'm not going to give any people any specific advice, but a simple Google search on how to invest to beat inflation.
Yeah.
You know, gold, commodities, oil, foreign currencies, anything but American cash.
Anything but American cash. Well, that's something that we haven't heard for the last 200 years, but we're starting to hear. You are listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're here talking with Michael Everett about his book, Recession's End. And by the way, you can buy that book at recessionsend.com. So, Mike, what do you think the individual stuck in their own personal recession still can do to get out of both the psychological and the financial economic cycle of it? Just kind of, you know, fairly brief synopsis of what a person can do who's kind of just languishing, right? Depressed, maybe.
Well, I think the big thing, first of all, is to understand that recession is, for many people, a psychological phenomenon. I mean, not to discount a lot of people who have lost their jobs or have really been through the ringer in terms of bankruptcies and foreclosures and, you know, all the horrible things that come along with economic downturn. But I think it's the understanding that it begins with the individual. There's a saying by one of my favorite authors and speakers by the name of Brian Tracy, and it simply says, if it is to be, it is up to me. And as we sit and we watch our televisions and our internet homepages and our magazines, and I got the copy of Newsweek this morning, and wow, somebody needs to put the editor on suicide watch. The last four issues have been absolutely horrible. The cover stories about how we're just going to hell in a handbasket. And I think for an individual to just step away from your television, step away from all of that news that's like, oh, things are getting, oh, no, they're terrible, and they're going to continue to be terrible. And understand that this is a wonderful time to maybe step back and reinvent yourself. You know, that's what our economy does over and over again. We're about to launch onto the next big thing as a macro economy. How about as an individual, take this opportunity to figure out what it is that you want to do? And do that independent of whether your television, your radio, or your internet homepage tells you that it's okay to do so or not. You know, there's what they call the Pareto principle. It's the 80-20 rule. And, you know, basically what they say is that 20% of the population rules 80% of the wealth. Or in sales, 20% of the sales force makes 80% of the sales. And I'd like to think that there's 20% of our population right now that is making plans and preparing and acting for the next phase so that when the economy turns, they're at the front of the line. They've already got all of their hooks baited and their nets out, and they're ready for the next big catch. 80% of our population is sitting at home right now waiting for their televisions to tell them that it's okay to come out and play again. And I think that for the individual, that's the big differentiation you can make.
It's kind of like the sheep waiting to be told when they're ready to be sheared, and there are always the people with the shears ready to do that. And that's really, you know, what a market economy is about. So you mentioned, Michael, a couple of times, the next big thing and the beginning of the next cycle and what will drive the next run-up. So what do you think will happen to drive the next cycle of our economy?
Two words. Goldman Sachs.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Well, okay. Goldman Sachs, love them or hate them. And of course, they got a lot of really bad press during the bailout and the stimulus. You know, they really kind of smoking gun pointed from them. And what I learned in my research over and over and over again is that they have developed the unique ability to create a market. They can create a market for a commodity, invest in it, get everybody else to come along and invest behind them. And as soon as that product or commodity or sector peaks, they pull their money out and everybody else is left scrambling. And they make money all the way up and then they short it all the way down.
Yeah.
And they've been doing that for the last 50 years.
Yeah, the smart money managers, they're the people with the shears mm-hmm. herding the sheep into the pen to be sheared.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But, you know, finally I arrived at a point where after seeing the words Goldman Sachs over and over again, it dawned on me, well, if you want to know where the economy is going, look at what Goldman Sachs is doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And over and over and over again, I found investments that they've been making in alternative energy.
Really?
And they've been going around and buying up a lot of majority stakes in some of the smaller wind, diesel, biofuel, hydroelectricity, coal.
Hmm.
And then some of the larger players like T. Boone Pickens, who's the Oracle of Omaha, Warren Buffett. He became a major stockholder in an alternative energy company recently. And all of a sudden it dawned on me. And then I was watching the State of the Union speech recently, and President Obama said in no uncertain terms, folks, we're going green. So my theory is that we are about to experience an industrial renaissance in the sense that up until now, if you wanted to go green, it was a moral imperative.
Yeah, it was kind of a philosophical thing. And to me, it seemed like something that was driven more by tax credits and by good intentions than by hard economic reality. But you're saying that hard money managers and money makers like Goldman Sachs view it as a money-making business that's going to boom. And drive the next economy like the dot-com did in the late 90s.
We finally figured out a way to make it profitable. We're
okay.
Right on the cusp of making alternative energy not only profitable, but extremely profitable.
Hmm.
And that's what's going to drive the next big thing in our economy, in my opinion.
Okay. Well, that's a good concrete prediction and something that people can start to act on. So, all right, they can look up Goldman Sachs. How can they easily find out what Goldman Sachs is investing in
you
online?
Bet. You bet. And that's really all you have to do is just Google Goldman Sachs alternative energy. There's also a really good article in Rolling Stone magazine a couple of years ago written by a guy by the name of Matt Tabby. And it's a very scathing article. It's not a really positive Goldman Sachs piece, but it outlines in no uncertain terms what they've been up to lately. And it even lists the companies that they've been purchasing by name.
Okay. So that's advice. And all of you out there who would like to maybe stop being sheared and begin to be wielding the shears yourself a little bit, look at what Goldman Sachs is investing in the green economy. And if you have any money on the side, try to do a little of that maybe. The book is Recession's End, Stimulus for the Rest of Us. The website, www.recessionsend.com. Michael Everett's the author. Michael, thank you so much for being on with us in American Variety.
Thanks for having me, Cort. I really appreciate it.
It's been fun. Thanks to all for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place for more American Variety Radio.